Thank you, Doris, for that. It's good to be back with you. I walked in today and, I was thinking how many years it's been since Karen and I have been coming down here. In fact, I think 1 week we came down, I wasn't even preaching. I just wanted to be with you, you know. And I thought of the old show Cheers. You remember years ago? And they had a theme song on there that says, "You want to be where everybody knows your name." And I know that must be true here, because one of the things I usually do when I'm preaching somewhere is I check out the bulletin first and see if my name is in the bulletin, because I may have gotten the wrong week. And I notice in the bulletin this week, my name is not in the bulletin. So I figure you already know my name, and that's okay, right? By the way, before I begin, I want to invite you all to the Sunday School Hour afterwards. I think we have a combined group meeting today. Sometimes we do this. It's too early for lunch anyway. So come down and we'll do a Sunday school. I've got something in mind today that I think you might enjoy. I'm going to do the 10 most important words in the Bible. Wow. Can you put them all together in 10? Yeah, I think we can, because we have in the Bible what we call program text. By program text, we mean the texts that occur over and over and over again. Like, for instance, Genesis 12, that says to Abraham, "I want you to go, I'm going to make you a great nation, and I'm going to bless you, but by you all the nations of the earth will be blessed." That turns up again and again and again, 19 times in the Bible. So obviously this was important to the biblical writers. So come and enjoy that today. We're not only going to be dealing with program words, the 10 most important program words, but also we're going to deal with them in the world of the biblical people, not in our world. See, sometimes we apply a definition to these funny Greek and Hebrew words, and then there are definitions that fit our lives, but they don't exactly fit to the lives of the people that live them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, this is the word that will appear in your text, but this is what it really meant in the lives and the hearts and the brains of the people who lived so long ago and actually lived out the Bible. So have I whet your appetite for that? I can hardly wait to hear what I'm going to say, So we'll see. Anyway, really good to be back with you. And I asked Pastor Albert, what would you like me to preach about today? He said, as Pastor Albert would, he said, something good. Okay. And then he said, yeah, something basic for the church. And I like that. You know, when I look at what's behind here by the cross, what do we exist for? Why do we show up here on a Sunday morning? It's because we want to be disciples of Christ, and we want to make disciples. That's our priority. We do that without prejudice, without thought, because our Master and Lord commanded us to do it, and that's what we want to do. So I want to get into that with you a little bit today. And I'm going to assume, by the way, that all of you are here this morning because you want to be here. Is that right? You love the church, right? A few of you, I'm not too sure. You didn't respond to that. So maybe we'll have to check you out after the service. Anyway, okay, let me, since we're friends here, you know, this is the truth room this morning, right? You know my name. I know your name. I know Esther and King's name. I know Bill's name. I know your names, you know? So we can be honest with one another. Let me ask you something. Do you ever have issues with the church? Okay, now you don't have to answer that right now. Let me confess. I'll be the first one. I do sometimes. Not so much with the church. It's more with the churchiness of the church. You know what I mean? You know, that's what kind of gets to me sometimes. The quirky things that can go on in churches. There are turf battles, and there are competitiveness and grudges, and always something to bicker about. You know, I watched yesterday one of my favorite movies on TV. It was, Karen will testify to this, my dad's favorite movie. He passed away a couple of years ago, and I told Karen after breakfast, I'm going to watch this movie because it's a movie about the church. And the movie's called One Foot in Heaven with Frederick March. If you haven't seen that, you have to watch that. It really described what it means to be a believer. We live with one foot on the ground and one foot in heaven already. But anyway, as I looked at they give you kind of a libretto that tells you what the movie's going to be about, you know, so you want to know if you want to watch it or not. And what it says is, this is a guy who lived going from church to church, dealing with the orneriness of people. Wouldn't it be great if we had churches without people? But fortunately, we need people in the church, right? Now, I say all this stuff, and you need to understand, I don't mean your church. I'm talking about other churches out there, you know. I only present it to you because I know you're praying people, and I present it as a prayer request for you. We need to pray for some of those churches that just can't get it right. I tell you, I was in Russia last summer with my wife, and I was delivering a course there to a group of people they call the Baptist Union. Now, when I hear Baptist Union, wouldn't you figure these are going to be people who are going to be together people? They're committed to the same thing, right? Otherwise, why do you call it Baptist Union? But before the course, my translator comes to me and he says this. He says, now, this Baptist Union is really made up of three different Baptist groups. And these groups never agree with one another about anything. In fact, the rule is that if you say something that any one group agrees with, the other group will automatically disagree with you. And I said, oh, my word. What have I gotten myself into here? I'm in trouble, aren't I? And the translator said very wisely, he said, well, really, the good thing is that I'm translating for you, so it really doesn't matter what you say anyway. It only matters what I say. I'll keep you out of trouble here. Anyway, I mean, it was a picture again of the church. You know, the church that wants to be together, that needs to be together, but somehow always manages to create divisions that drive wedges between us. And we have to constantly be dealing with these things. Maybe you know the radio personality Garrison Keillor. Have you heard of him? You listen to him on Saturday night. Great stuff, right? Prairie Home Companion. You young folks, if you've never seen this, give you a good idea what local culture in the upper Midwest is all about. And Garrison Keillor lives in this semi-mythical town, I think. It's called Lake Wobegon, up there in Minnesota where he grew up. My wife doesn't think this is funny because she was born in upper Minnesota. But he gets into a lot of ridiculous stuff about the folk culture there. And some of his funniest stories are about the church. He has this great line. He says, in our church, we were cursed with a surplus of scholars and a deficit of peacemakers. He said, our people were forever lining up on one side or the other of an issue over minuscule points of doctrine and practice. Keillor says that the only church leader who steered clear of this infighting was a guy by the name of Brother Brown. So as not to be accused of taking sides in any one of these squabbles, Brother Brown had just decided to avoid fellowship with everybody. Anyway, there's still something about the church, though, isn't it? With all of these foibles and all of these messes and everything, there's still something that's very good about the church, something that's compelling. Otherwise, why are you here today? We're drawn to it because we sense that the church is close to the heart of God. It's at the center of what God is about in this world. She's hard to live with at times, but if we're to be Christian, we have to be honest and say that we can't really survive without the church. Woody Allen has this joke in his movie Annie Hall. I mean, if you've seen Annie Hall, you'll probably remember this. It's the joke at the end of the movie, which really puts this ridiculous movie together. It's sort of a weird joke. But he talks about a guy who goes to see a psychiatrist one day. And he tells the psychiatrist, he says, Doc, I've got a big problem. And the psychiatrist says, what's the problem? He said, well, it's my brother. My brother thinks he's a chicken. And the psychiatrist says, oh, that's a serious problem. You need to commit him. We need to have him in the hospital for a while. And the guy said, well, Doc, I would, but the problem is I need the eggs. I have to think about that one just a little bit. In that life, I mean, it gets crazy sometimes. And it's like the church, but we can't give up on the church in the end. We can't commit her because in the end, we need the eggs. It's important to be clear about what the church is about, right? I like this stuff on the back of, you know, behind me here, that's pretty clear. It's a reminder for you every week, isn't it? Who you are and what you're supposed to do with your lives. So in spite of our mistakes of doing church, we still need to remain passionate about what the church is about, what Christ has left us here for, what he's left us here to do. Maybe you remember that at the beginning, Jesus chose 12 disciples, and he says to these 12 guys, I want you to go out and be a light to the nations. Just go out there and do what I do. Say what I've said. And later he'd send out 72 guys with the same challenge. So from the very beginning, this thing called church is an expanding thing. It was never supposed to be a come and watch deal. It was always supposed to be a go and do deal. The whole idea of church meetings took a long time to develop in the church because everybody was sort of being the church out there in the world. And so at the end of Jesus' ministry, just before the ascension, he launches a major mission. Doris read it to us today. We read about it at the end of the Gospel of Matthew. It's a key passage. It sums up the entire gospel message. Jesus is standing on a hill with his disciples. And remember, we're told that there were only 11 of them because somebody has kind of decided it's too much to ask. Judas has betrayed Jesus. He preferred the world system to this system that Jesus was trying to ingrain. And then it says that they worshiped him, but some doubted. Now, it would be extraordinary today that some of us don't have some doubts about, you know, what the church is all about and what we're supposed to do with our lives. It's very natural. But Jesus rises above all of those doubts. And he says, here, let me put it together for you. All authority on heaven and on earth has been given to me. Well, that kind of focuses it, doesn't it? You don't really have questions about your own life. Jesus is the one that reserves the right to tell you what to do with your life. Well, that doesn't really compute in our world, does it? Because the whole idea of to be strong and to be a viable human being is to retain all those rights of ourselves. But Jesus says very clearly, if you're going to be the church, you got to get things straight. There's one head, and that's all there is. A multi-headed thing is not going to get the job done. So he says, since all authority has been given to me, I want you to go. To go. And here's what I want you to do when you go. I want you to make disciples of all nations, baptizing them and teaching them to obey whatever I've commanded you. Right. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Now, what are the odds that this would come to anything? I mean, tiny little groups with no financing at all, in a world that's alien to the gospel message and in an obscure corner of it to boot, and no multimedia of any kind. What are the odds that anything would come of this dream that Jesus has? Today we call it the Great Commission, as Doris mentioned. We call it great because it was not just for those first followers of Jesus, you see. It's supposed to be our commission, right here, today, just as if we were there when Jesus said it. And since it's for the church today, then it is for this church and for every church. And if any church today stops putting this at the forefront of what it is, then it cannot be the church that Jesus intended the church to be. Let me tell you a story. Years ago, Karen and I were living in Boston. We were far removed from our families. We both grew up in the Midwest. So we decided to do something different for Christmas because the flights to Fargo, North Dakota, and St. Louis, Missouri were a little bit expensive, and we didn't have a lot of money in graduate school. And we said to each other, well, we won't be in New England forever, so let's do something quintessentially New England and spend Christmas, just the two of us, on one of the offshore islands off the southern coast, Cape Cod. Well, we had to decide where to go. And that year, strangely enough, we had no invitations from the Kennedy family on Martha's Vineyard. So we decided then to take this nauseating winter's ferry ride off Cape Cod to Nantucket Island. I don't know how Karen thinks about this, but it was one of my favorite Christmases. It still is, because it's so different than what we had done before or since. We had the best Christmas. We visited all the local museums, many of which were dedicated to the mariner culture of the New England coastline. And one of these was a little organization created by Nantucketers about 150 years ago. They called it the Nantucket Life-Saving Society. Traveling by sea in the 19th century was extremely dangerous. The fishing industry and the shipping lanes in the stormy North Atlantic brought many boats close to the rocky coast of Nantucket. Shipwrecks were common. Boats near Nantucket could see land, but they couldn't negotiate the rocks that were just hidden beneath the surface of the sea. So the citizens of Nantucket decided to do something about this. They decided to go into the life-saving business. They formed a little society to keep watch at sea all the times. They built these little shelters all along the coastline, and they called them huts of refuge. I hear you can still see some of them today, although we didn't scout them out. And they put launches in these shelters with food and blankets and all kind of rescue gear. And these volunteers, they kept watch 24/7. And whenever they spotted a ship that was in trouble or perhaps going down, word would spread and the members would go out to sea on rescue missions. Now, they did this for no compensation, no recognition whatsoever. They did it just because they knew the dangers of their coastline and because they prized human life that much. They even had a motto. This is funny. Here was the motto. You have to go out, but you don't have to come back. Whoa. Those are pretty sobering words, aren't they? I mean, how many people are you going to recruit like that, with a motto like that? But the facts are, they recruited many people. Young people, old people, children were involved in this. And these folks willingly put their lives at risk for people that they had never met. The Nantucket Life-Saving Society. So what happened? Why is it in a museum today? Well, in time, things just changed. The U.S. government commissioned the Coast Guard with a specific job of guarding the coastline of the United States. So the members of the Nantucket Life-Saving Society figured, well, now the professionals have come. They can take over. Servicemen, they're going to be better trained, they're going to be better equipped, they'll just be better at the whole life-saving effort. So the Nantucket Life-Saving Society quietly, slowly, just got out of the life-saving business. They shut down their life-saving efforts. They closed up the coastal shelters. They eliminated their 24-hour vigils. The activities just stopped. Everything. Everything that is, except for the society itself. That didn't stop. See, they'd been around for so long, and the members had developed all of these friendships and traditions together, they just couldn't disband. So they would continue to meet. They had parties. They'd gather for social occasions to recognize people with awards for community service. They did lots of good stuff. They just weren't in the life-saving business anymore. They became sort of a yacht club. You know what I mean? An association of pleasure boaters. Now, I want to suggest something to you. This happens to churches all the time, often before we even know it. Somehow we just quietly get out of the life-saving business. We still have our buildings where we have performances and we have meetings. We have dinners and social events, and we conduct weekly programs for all ages. Let's be honest, we fill a niche in the institutions that are in our communities. We do some good here. But the honest-to-goodness risk-taking rescue efforts, which originally defined the church, are now pretty much things of the past. They're topics of sermons or Sunday school discussions. But here's the thing. People around us, their lives are still spiritually shipwrecked, aren't they? That hasn't changed. Lives are still in danger. People are still crashing on the rocks. But no one is much paying attention to the horizon anymore. No one's scouring the neighborhoods or the offices or the schools or the cities for the people who are in trouble. Churches can become yacht clubs. And the thing about yacht clubs is they exist primarily for the benefit of the enjoyment of its members. That's where all the money goes, right? So when the members are not accommodated, it's common to hear folks complain. They argue about the food, or about the music, or about the programming, or about the qualifications of the members. They argue about most anything. And here's the thing. These are things that people in the honest-to-goodness life-savings business don't have time to argue about. The stakes are just too high. In fact, the life-saving society doesn't even exist for the members at all. It exists for people who don't even know that the society exists, for people who are not members. And when a church forgets about the commission to go out and bring to the lost a safe harbor, it forgets about the very thing that makes it a church. Now, here's another thing. The church was not just called out. It was called together. Saving a lost world is not something that any one person should do alone. It's not supposed to be an individual thing. That's why we call it a church. This word, both in the Hebrew language and the Greek language, means a gathering, a people assembled and commingled, a community created by Christ and chiseled by interaction with one another. Let me ask you something. Do you know what the best thing about the church is? It's people. People. When I was young, we used to have this little thing that we did. I don't know if they do it anymore, but we'd do it in Sunday school. We'd say, here is the church. Here is the steeple. Whoops. Open the doors. And look at all the people. And you had to be careful to do it right, because if you opened the doors and you hadn't put your fingers right, there were no people there. See, somewhere along the line, I missed it. I always thought the church was boards and rafters and plaster and stuff. It's not. The church is the people. Now, do you know what the greatest problem is for the church? It's people. And you think, well, not me, of course, but the people sitting next to me. Don't look around. In his book, Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis argues about the greatest temptation of the evil one. He said it's to get us to look around rather than within. We do this Pharisee thing. It's so natural to do, isn't it? To focus on the imperfections of others. To look at all the things we don't like about the way people are. But see, Jesus said, all authority has been given to me. The authority of Christ puts our eyes where they belong, not on the person next to us, and not really on ourselves, but on Jesus himself. The great tragedy of the church is we become a people who take what we want from Jesus, what we need, but then we deny him the authority over our lives that he claims to have over the church. And then inevitably we retreat into our private, self-controlling lives. You know, the way we live the other 6 days. See, if Jesus is truly my authority, I simply cannot continue to run my own life. And that really runs against the grain of the way I think and the way my culture would teach me to think. A while back, church researcher George Barner wrote these words. Listen to what he said. He said, we're headed toward a day when every person in society will have his own customized religion. Won't that be nice? We'll have designer faiths. Have you ever heard someone say about someone else, he's a person of faith? I guess that'll all be the only thing that matters, right? To be a person of faith. Problem, Jesus did not say this. All authority has been given to you to design yourself a custom-made religious experience. He didn't say that. Jesus says, I am the authority. And it is faith in Jesus and our willingness to obey his orders that makes us his church. And the order is to go. To go. And to make disciples who will go. And then he adds, and teaching them to obey what I've commanded you. That's the gospel. It's the story of Jesus. Who he is and what he said. That's what's going to draw hearts to him. Apart from Christ, let's be honest, we have no capacity to do much for anybody. Personal religious experience can't save anybody's soul. You on your own, what can you do to change a person's character? But a life truly committed to the authority of Christ, lived out in community with others who are under the authority of Christ, now that's the church. And that, my friends, is a life-saving society. So we've got to submit to the authority of Christ. Pretty scary. How do we do that? Well, you know, the Bible says it's kind of a cycle. The Bible says that the most practical way of submitting to Christ is to place yourself in submission to other people. We submit to Christ through the shared experience of submitting to one another. Now, it's not quite that simple. Here's the rub. Submitting to others takes place with people who are not like us, people we wouldn't ordinarily associate with. In a community where we don't always get our way, where people don't always agree with our doctrine or our view of the end times or with our preferred worship style. But that's exactly how we get straightened out about the authority of Christ in our lives. We're joined together as one body with all of its differences, Paul says. And we've got to get over the notion that we can function separately. But in the church, it seems, we're inclined to separate all the time. Have you noticed? If you don't like what's going on in the church, what do? You're out of there. On to the next church, right? Somebody told me a story a while back about a guy who, I hope it's not true, a guy who gets marooned on a desert island. He's there for 15 years. And finally they find him there. And they come in, they find that he's got three huts on the coast of the desert island. They say, "Why do you have three huts? What's going on here?" He said, "Well, that hut right over there, that's my house." The rescuer said, "Yeah, that makes sense. What's that hut?" He said, "Well, that's my church." "Okay, well, what's this other hut?" He said, "That's the church I used to go to." Crazy, isn't it? I love the picture of the disciples in Matthew 10. What a mixed bag these guys are. We've got some Judeans, we got a few Pereans, and a bunch of Galileans. Now, these are really different people. They don't spell that out because they figure we live there and we understand that you don't mix these groups together. We're talking here button-down Episcopalians and a few snake-handling Adventists and a whole mess of Holy Ghost and fire Pentecostals. How are these people going to get along in the same fellowship? Major differences here. And then among them, there's this guy named Simon the Zealot. Do you remember? Yeah. The Zealots were Jewish political revolutionaries. At a time when things were relatively quiet in Galilee, the Zealots stirred up considerable unrest, advocating widespread organized violence against the Romans. These guys were terrorists. This was a radical right-wing movement devoted to God in ways that were really destructive to human communities. They believed that paying taxes to the Roman authority was an act of idolatry. And so, besides the Romans, their most hated enemies were Jewish tax farmers who worked for the Romans. The Zealots put out contracts on these tax farmers. They targeted them for death. Okay, now, alongside the disciple Simon the Zealot is another disciple, Levi. Matthew, we call him. He's the guy responsible for the first gospel. Yeah. Now, what does Matthew do for a living? He's one of these tax farmers. Two guys, Simon the Zealot and Matthew the tax farmer, sitting next to each other, holding hands, trying to pray together. You can imagine that they got a shiv ready for the each one, right? You know, how is this going to, who would put two guys this different in the same small group together? Well, turns out Jesus would. See, Jesus' community is the place where the person you least want to be with is right there sitting next to you this morning. This point is, we learn how to be an us by being with people who are not like us. But that's not the way we do church today. Churches are generally not like that. Today, we're forming churches around certain age groups, around certain economic strata, around certain lifestyles, even around certain ethnic backgrounds and cultural connections. We want community where people have affinities with one another, where people can more easily get along with one another. We're not really forming communities where people have to submit to one another. It seems to me that the world's looking for a church where people can learn to love each other despite their differences. The other's pretty natural. They can find that at the Y. See, it's working through these differences that purifies our love for God. And that's the kind of love that the world's really looking for, I believe. So it's precisely these differences that make us the church. Whether we're blue-jeaned, blue-blooded, or blue-haired, with all of our differences, we're the church. Last point. Not enough to just be different. We're not enough just to be different people. We've got to open up with one another. We have to be real. We have to be authentic people. We've got to expose ourselves at our most vulnerable areas. Now, that's pretty scary, isn't it? James in the New Testament encourages his listeners to confess their sins to one another as a path toward healing. There's not a whole lot of that really going on in the church these days, is there? Too painful. And it can be downright humiliating if you do it right. The message becomes clear. I'll let you pretend to be what you're not if you let me pretend to be what I'm not. Fair? Sounds good, but it ain't the church. Here's the thing. When we're honest with one another, When we're honest with each other about our real weaknesses, we make room for the other person to be honest with us about their weaknesses. And then we're united precisely in our weakness. And that's what the church is all about. There's this great story in the Old Testament about two brothers. I'm sure you remember it. Jacob and Esau. These guys were twins, but they're as different as night and day. They grew up to absolutely hate each other. And the Bible tells us it was a raw, gnawing hatred. One of them actually swindled the other out of his birthright. Now, we don't have birthrights so much today, but in that culture, that means that he robbed him out of everything that his life was supposed to be. He had no home. He had no family. His wife was going to be somebody else. His kid was going to be somebody else. This guy should have had a certain life, and he didn't have that life because of his own brother. Now, they didn't leave on the best of terms. And in fact, one of them swears that if you don't get out of here right now, I'm going to kill you. A quarter of a century later, they come back together. And Jacob, the swindler here, decides to go back home and meet with his brother Esau. It took him a quarter of a century to get around to doing this. We're sure when they see each other, something really bad is going to happen. Fight's going to break out at the very least. But the night before they meet, do you remember? One of them, Jacob, the swindler, has an encounter with God. And in this encounter, a weakness is exposed in him. God touches him in such a way that impairs his ability to walk. He becomes disabled. Jacob, the capable one, the one who always figured out a way to get his own way, this brother now walks with a limp. Well, the next day, Jacob sees Esau coming, and he sees him with 400 troops. I'd run, wouldn't you? That's not a good sign. Genesis 33:1, here's what it says. But what does Esau see? He sees a person in the distance, walking with a limp. He sees the brother who cheated him, the brother who always took advantage of him, the brother he swore he would kill if he ever saw him again. But now that brother doesn't look so threatening. The thing that Esau sees is the limp. Immediately something happens. His anger begins to melt away. That resentment that he'd nurtured for so many years, he doesn't feel it anymore. And he runs to Jacob. Now, in that society, that's not a dignified thing to do, to run to someone, but that's what he does. And when they meet, they end up in each other's arms. They can be brothers again. Our world today says, be strong, be smart, come out on top whenever you can. By all means, don't expose your limp. So we spend much of our lives and much of our church work working hard at limp management, disguising our weaknesses, trying to look better than we actually are. It's natural, but it's not the church. That the verse in 1 John in the New Testament, here's what it says. I'm going to paraphrase it if you don't mind. It says, if we say that we have no limp, we make God a liar, and the truth is not in us. But if we confess our limps, we can have fellowship one with another. The church was created by Christ to be a blessed gathering of all kinds of people. People who are willing to be together and to live open lives with one another. And together those people went. They went. And all they had to back them was the command of their Lord. But they went to rescue a world marooned on the rocks. They were a life-saving society without prejudice and without other priority. And they carried forth the deep passion of their Savior in the world. And folks, they turned their world upside down. The Roman Empire could not sustain itself. It imploded under the power of the Church of Jesus Christ. And let me tell you, when that kind of thing happens, the church becomes the church. Listen to the words of Samuel Stone. Wrote them 200 years ago at a time when the church was dealing with divisions inside and war on the outside. He wrote these words. The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord. She is his new creation by water and the word. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he brought her, he bought her, and for her life he died. Mid toil and tribulation, tumults of her war, she waits the consummation of peace forevermore. Till with the vision glorious her longing eyes are blessed, and the great church victorious shall be the church at rest. I'd like you to stand as we close this morning. I'd like us to affirm together what we've heard this morning, our intention going forward. And I'd like you, if you don't mind, to hold the hand of the person next to you, that person that you know has all kinds of problems, and you hope they get straightened out by this time next week. Join hands together. Have a hand to hold. Good. Now repeat after me, will you? We are the church.
We are the church.
We are a life-saving society.
We are a life-saving
society. We are not a yacht club.
We are not a yacht club.
We will fellowship together under the authority of Christ.
We will fellowship together under the authority of Christ.
We will celebrate our differences.
We will confess our weaknesses.
We will spread the gospel of Jesus Christ everywhere at all cost.
We will spread the gospel of Jesus Christ everywhere at all cost.
We will be the church.
We will be the church.
So help us, God.
So help us, God.
And may that be so. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. God bless you. Be seated.